in the limelight.
Despite Biden's characterization of Obama's mass deportations as a mistake and pledge to usher in a more humane immigration system, United We Dream estimates that the administration has deported just over 300,000 people since January, largely using a Trump-era policy called Title 42, says Jake Johnson, writer in an article titled, "With 300,000 deported in first 100 days, rights group warns Biden well on track to repeat Obama failures." Stay tuned, please, for the details. Rights group United We Dream has recently warned that unless he takes immediate steps to improve his administration's treatment of immigrants, President Joe Biden is at serious risk of repeating the destructive failures of former President Barack Obama, who deported roughly 3 million people during his 8 years in office. Despite Biden's characterization of Obama's mass deportations as a mistake, and pledged to usher in a more humane immigration system, United We Dream estimates that the administration has deported just over 300,000 people since January, largely using a Trump-era policy called Title 42. The policy was first issued by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, last March at the start of the coronavirus pandemic and has been kept in place by the Biden administration. As Human Rights Watch, HRW, explained earlier this month, the Title 42 expulsion policy has effectively closed the U.S. border to nearly all asylum seekers based on the misapplication of an obscure 75-year-old public health law. That law, the Public Health Service Act of 1944, was designed to confer quarantine authority to health authorities that would apply to everyone, including U.S. citizens, arriving from a foreign country, HRW noted. Quarantine authority was never meant to be used to determine which non-citizens could or couldn't be expelled or removed from the U.S. In a statement recently, Cynthia Garcia of United We Dream stressed that Title 42 was designed under one of the most anti-immigrant administrations in modern history. President Biden and the Department of Homeland Security must be reminded that their inaction to protect vulnerable immigrant communities seeking refuge in the U.S. is not only putting lives in the line, it upholds the white nationalist immigration system that seeks to expel and keep black and brown immigrants out at any cost, said Garcia, who voiced dismay at the Biden administration's deportation of vulnerable Haitians and others. According to a report released late last month by the Haitian Bridge Alliance and other advocacy groups, the Biden administration used Title 42 to deport more people during its first weeks in power than the Trump administration did in all of fiscal year 2020. Reflecting on his time as vice president, President Biden acknowledged that the Obama administration was wrong in deporting over 2.5 million people and vowed to never make that mistake again when he took office, Garcia continued. President Biden is well on track to repeat history. Now he must make a choice. repeat the mistakes of the Obama administration, or do everything in its power to end the cruelty of detentions, expulsions, and deportations, and show that he is a president of his word. National Partnership for New Americans, NPNA, a coalition of more than 40 immigrants and refugee rights organizations, echoed United We Dream's concerns about continued mass deportations during the first 100 days of the Biden administration. NPNA noted that there are many changes that the Biden administration can pursue with little to no congressional action, including ending the use of Title 42 expulsions, designating temporary protected status for Haiti and other countries that are set to expire, and increasing the number of refugees that the United States will resettle as part of the presidential determination. These are literally life or death decisions that will impact millions of lives, the group said. It continued, the administration can also take action to expand access to citizenship and justice and to bolster due process protections through an increase of legal representation for those in detention and removal proceedings.
Aperture.
Once every 100,000 years, gold is created from the collision of neutron stars. Mysterious gold instantly melted into humanity's desire, contained the magic which enabled civilizations to flourish and fueled the desire that made people venture across oceans. But why do we lust after gold? And does humanity own gold? Or does gold own humanity? I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For centuries, gold was the economic index which dominated the world before it lost to the dollar. But the 2008 financial meltdown has brought gold back from oblivion. Gold is now dominating the world once again, but why is it gold again? In 2008, gold woke up from its deep, dark sleep. As the dollar became unstable during the U.S. financial crisis, people rushed to gold, and in August of 2011, the twisted destiny recurred. The new gold rush started again. Pursuit has begun once again, and stay with us as we take a look into the history of gold from its glittering past to its sudden return.
Gold.
That is gold.
Kingai.
King or
gold.
Gold.
With gold.
Gold.
El oro.
The oro.
Oro.
Into gold.
Sold gold.
Gold.
Gold price.
Gold mines. Gold is undervalued.
Currency, which reflects human instincts, is very much alive. Money gained humanity's passionate desire since its creation. Money was at the center of wars and economies. Its origin can be traced back to Mesopotamia. Thousands of years ago, Sumerians were the first ever to develop trade. Since then, many types of currency have appeared in history. Trading goods for goods appeared first. Grains, essential for everyone, were used as currency in many areas. As time passed, smaller objects were used for trading to facilitate easier transportation and exchange. Various metals became the new currency, as they were easily transportable and did not rot. But not all metals were permanently stable. In the end, gold, whose value was accepted consistently as a stable metal, became the best currency. Gold, which is evaluated by its weight and purity, has no exchange rate or nationality. Due to its high value, large trades were made possible with just small amounts of gold. It was the best currency that was accepted everywhere. In 700 BC, the kingdom of Lydia, which ruled Turkey, became the birthplace of the best invention in the history of currency. The capital of the kingdom was Sardis. It was the hub of the East and West, and as trading became important, the need for currency grew. Lydia dominated Asia Minor. It expanded its boundaries as the ancient empire, securing the trade route linking an area of over 2,700 kilometers. Lydia invented the world's first gold coins, using their abundant resources of gold, and built an affluent kingdom.
And this started with King Croesus of Lydia, which is a very famous name. And he really produced the first gold coins and used it particularly to pay soldiers and military people.
In the early 7th century BC, Lydians minted the world's first coins. Gold coins, which feature a lion's head, the symbol of Lydia, became the kingdom's representative export goods. As the world's first gold coins and the world's first empire currency, Lydia's coins spread through Asia Minor and Greece. They became a necessity for trade in the Mediterranean. Goods, art, people, and knowledge gathered in Lydia, and humanity's first retail businesses began. With a single shiny gold coin, people were able to buy horses or delicious food. It also reduced shopping time. A new world had opened up for humanity. But if the Lydians were the first to invent coins, the Greeks were the first to turn coin making into an art form. Each city imprinted its own unique symbols. They were the symbols of national strength. Greek coins circulated the Mediterranean through marine commerce. Gold coins brought revolutionary developments in commerce and became the foundation of civilizations. Education also developed quickly along with the coins. Years after the birth of gold coins, the currency revolution moved to Rome. Coins featuring the emperor's face, as well as other royalty, were widely used among laymen. As the territory of the Roman Empire expanded, the amount of gold attained through looting and mining grew exponentially. Consequently, the Romans issued more gold coins, and these coins strengthened the empire. Gold coins were what built the Roman Empire. In 395 AD, after the Roman Empire divided into two, Western Rome collapsed within the next 100 years. However, the surviving Eastern Rome continued to write history for another 1,000 years. Constantine the Great moved Rome's capital to Byzantium and founded the Byzantine Empire. Constantine the Great, who reunited Rome, declared freedom from religion and chose Sunday as a day of rest. He also issued a new gold coin called Solidus. This is Byzant, the best currency. The Byzant, with a 98% purity, weighed 4.5 grams. The Byzant was the basic currency of the Middle Ages that everyone could trust and use. It was the longest surviving currency in history.
Really ran from about 500. Well, really 300 AD, but 500 AD in Istanbul itself, and lasted for almost 1,000 years, really with the weight and the purity of it unchanged. There were some years when it was a problem, but it did last almost for 1,000 years, the Byzantine solidus. It was a 1,000-year coin, if you like.
The Byzant was the revenue source to maintain a large army and the means of controlling the empire. That is why the Byzant is called the dollar of the Middle Ages. The dollar of the Middle Ages surpasses today's dollar in terms of stability and value. While today's dollar faced a crisis within 100 years, the Byzant survived for 1,000 years. The Byzant was the partner that supported the kingdom for 1,000 years. The value of gold transcends time and space and gives faith to people. But there was a critical weakness even to gold, the best currency. There is a limit to the production of gold, and there are three ways to overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you were a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge around them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins backed by the government played a similar role in the East. Whether it be gold or a brass coin, if the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square. So they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bozhou and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold. At the time, the population which had been devastated by the plague was bouncing back. Price of commodities was also increasing. Moreover, as gold and silver from the New World poured into Europe, prices soared uncontrollably. The price revolution of the 16th century began. Treasure from the New World created a large gap between the rich and the poor.
And this is at a time when that is much more than a week's earnings in the late. It's more like 2 weeks' earnings. So it is a lot of time to earn the smallest coin. And therefore, ordinary people do not have gold coins. It is something for the rich to have.
Prices quadrupled and sextupled. First, landowners who received a consistent amount of rent went bankrupt. Farmers who didn't have money to rent land became wage laborers. On the other hand, the royal families and noblemen enjoyed an unprecedented extravagance. Gold instantly spread throughout European countries, and in its wake, only collapsed industries and financial crisis remained. Such was the curse of gold. The price revolution continued on for over 100 years without any resolution. It was the longest inflation in history. When commerce expanded and capitalism developed, a barter economy emerged. A system of an exchange of promissory notes for foreign currency began. 48 types of gold coins used in Europe in the 16th century were all exchangeable. Thus, financial innovation was propelled by the power of gold. In the early 19th century, gold faced a new era. Money was dependent upon the value of gold. A system of gold and money exchange emerged. Since then, history repeatedly introduced and discarded the gold standard. In 1819, England pegged the value of pounds to gold and circulated paper money that could be exchanged for gold at any time. By 1870, most countries had adopted the gold standard, and the pound, which could be exchanged for gold, became the key currency around the world.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A panel of international human rights experts have called on the International Criminal Court in The Hague to investigate police violence against black Americans after releasing a 188-page report regarding the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Eric Garner, and countless others by law enforcement officers. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading International Rights Experts Condemn U.S. Police Killings as Crimes Against Humanity. Here's more. A panel of international human rights experts have called on the International Criminal Court in The Hague to investigate police violence against black Americans after releasing a 188-page report regarding the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Eric Garner, and countless others by law enforcement officers. The commission said the police killings of people of color in the U.S. constitute crimes against humanity, a finding it came to after hearing the testimonies of victims' families at virtual public hearings held earlier this year. "We are in the midst of a humanitarian crisis," Emily Galvin Almanza, founder of Partners for Justice, tweeted after the report was released. "The world is not only watching, it's judging," wrote historian Dr. Paula Lee. The decision to label police killings as crimes against humanity was not given lightly. Hina Jilani, one of the 12 commissioners and a pioneering Pakistani human rights lawyer, told The Guardian, "We examined all the facts and concluded that there are situations in the U.S. that beg the urgent scrutiny of the ICC. To constitute crimes against humanity, a crime must be widespread of systematic and must be the result of policy, meaning a state or organization intends to carry out an attack against a civilian population, whether through action or deliberate failure to take action." Experts from 11 countries formed the Commission of Inquiry on Systematic Racist Police Violence last year after the families of several black Americans killed by officers petitioned the United Nations to investigate the country's epidemic of violence. Under pressure from the Trump administration, the UN Human Rights Council declined to focus its inquiry on the U.S., which led the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, National Conference of Black Lawyers, and National Lawyers Guild to conduct their own investigation. The commissioners heard the stories of dozens of victims, including Michael Brown, whose fatal shooting by Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri, led to a wave of racial justice demonstrations in 2014. 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was killed after holding a toy gun in Cleveland Park that same year, and Freddie Gray, fatally injured while in Baltimore police custody in 2015. The testimonies led the commission to conclude that traffic stops by armed officers conducted under the pretext that drivers could be committing a crime are common precursors to excessive force and police killings. There exists in the U.S. a pattern of police violations of the Fourth Amendment rights of black people to be secure in their persons, houses, and effects from unreasonable searches and seizures. No-knock warrants, like the one used by Louisville police officers who shot Breonna Taylor in 2020, proliferate in cases of police violence against people of African descent. Lethal use of force against black Americans experiencing mental health crises, including Daniel Prude in Rochester, New York, and Shiri's Francis in New York City, both in 2020, is routine and systematic. And an alarming pattern of manipulation of evidence, cover-ups, obstruction of justice, and collusion between various arms of law enforcement exists in the U.S., including in the case of Michael Brown, in which the officer was permitted to back his own gun and wash the victim's blood off his hands, thus destroying evidence. Giuliani told The Guardian that the panel found the testimonies to be extremely distressing. This country, which claims to be a global champion of human rights, itself fails to comply with international law, she told the outlet, adding that the family's stories made it clear that this was no longer an account of individual trauma. It was an account of trauma inflicted on a whole section of the United States population. In its report, the commission called on the U.S. government to support the BRAVE Act, specifically those provisions aimed at divesting federal resources from incarceration and policing, and instead invest in new, non-punitive and non-carceral approaches to community safety utilizing funding incentives. Create an independent national federal law enforcement oversight commission with power to monitor and regulate the performance of all 18,000 police departments in the U.S. Implementing a zero-tolerance policy for instances of police brutality and use of excessive and deadly force. And remove qualified immunity, which protects police officers from civil lawsuits, and prohibit no-knock warrants and chokeholds, among other recommendations. The commission expressed hope that an investigation by the ICC would force the U.S. regime to support much-needed change, The Guardian reported. We felt that the U.S. would benefit war. Individual police officers further deterred from resorting to unjustified forces, knowing that some kind of international criminal responsibility might be held against them, Giuliani told the outlet.
Iran has a very long history from the very old times. Lubalawa technique, very special technique.
These two were made by one person. That is very interesting.
The South Iran around Persian Gulf is very important for searching the modern humans' route out of Africa.
The Persian Gulf.
Now we are in the site of the cave named Tangshkan or Seyd Hatun, and this is one of the largest cave in the Alexandrian area. The whole of the layers here belongs to the Middle Paleolithic period. It means about from the 80,000 years ago to the 40,000 years ago. And now this phase dates about the 70 or 80,000 years ago, depending on the lithic typology. And we discovered some structures, very interesting structures. For example, that this is a structure of the water supply.
Because a structure is nothing but the stones set around the small basin on the cave floor to prevent soil from being washed into the water and therefore have clean and clear water to drink.
So this is one of the oldest human structure of the water supply in the world, because it dates to the Middle Paleolithic period, 70 or 80,000 years ago. Now, we understand that they made some kind of a structure for water supply or for stone floor and so on. So the Middle Paleolithic people is much more advanced people than we expected before.
The first Australopithecus, Robustus, had small brains and were able to stand and walk upright. Homo habilis, that appeared around 2 million years ago, had bigger brains and started to make tools. Homo erectus got the ability to make use of fire. Homo sapiens, Neanderthalensis, that were the closest relatives of modern human, appeared in Europe around 200,000 years ago, and we, Homo sapiens, as modern humans of today, appeared in Africa around 150,000 years ago. The last two species lived together for thousands of years, but Homo sapiens, Neanderthalensis, disappeared forever around 30,000 years ago.
The archaeologists thought there are two routes for out of Africa. One route is via Egypt, via Sinai, and another route via Arabian Peninsula to the Persian Gulf. For the out of Africa, for these two routes, the people used the different periods. For the southern route, the out of Africa, what happened in the very dry periods because of the level of the sea level of the Red Sea and sea level of the Persian Gulf is very low.
Melting or expanding of Earth's glaciers has been a major factor affecting sea level changes. Every time Earth experienced an ice age, the sea level dramatically fell.
Touching the southern route, the South Iran around Persian Gulf is very important. And Alsanjan is, of course, located in the southern Iran. So this is the reason why we started our archaeological research in Alsanjan area.
Excavate an ancient archaeological site, archaeologists first consider a part of the site, then they start to dig the ground layers in a very careful way. During excavation, the exact location of the discovered works and antiquities is recorded. Soil from the excavation is analyzed by archaeobotanists and archaeozoologists to find seeds, pollen, bones, and animal remains in order to precisely rebuild the environment of that era. The shape of the objects is also analyzed to find out the techniques used in making them.
From this excavation, we discovered a lot of mysterium point like this. They are the very typical in the Middle Paleolithic period in the Zagros area. For example, this mysterium point was made on Lubalawa technique, very special technique of the Middle Paleolithic period.
It is very hard work. It was used for hunting animals like gazelle, deer, horse, anything. From layer 7, we found this core. It is called Lubalawa blade core. And last year, we surveyed the area around the cave, and we collected this core. And from experimentation point of view, these two were completely the same. So I think these two were made by one person. I think one person, maybe 70,000 years ago, walked between the cave site and open site. That is very interesting.
Iran has a very long history from the very old times. And all of these sites are very important for the human history.
Signs of early human are not just seen in the Persian Gulf region. The tools made by them are also found in the Persian Gulf islands, like Lakhdesh, that were once connected to the mainland of Persia. Within thousands of years, humans learned new techniques for making more delicate and efficient tools for their expanded activities. Gradual warming of Earth's climate made the vegetation coverage denser, so much so that there was no more need for humans to constantly move in search for food. Consequently, first steps towards sedentism were taken. Sedentism caused populations to gradually increase, and this had a negative impact on food resources. In the process of domestication, humans succeeded in raising some animals unlike their primitive ancestors that were able to produce more milk and wool than their needs. After about 1,000 years of grain farming, our ancestors could find crops that had the capability of being kneaded.
After the domestication of plants and animals, and when man could produce his basic needs, he gradually began to exchange the excess products. This was the beginning of a phenomenon called trade. Later, during late Sedentism and early urbanization, human beings gradually started to choose their own field of specialization. Communications were developed, fixed routes emerged, and trade became global. One of the most important of those routes is today known as the Silk Road. There are two ways to realize the events in the distant past. one to study the historical texts, and the other, findings from archaeological excavations. Some pieces of evidence found through archaeological excavations in the Persian Gulf region prove the existence of marine communications among various civilizations of the ancient world. The formation of Sassanid Empire happened in 224 AD when the Parthian king Ardavan V was defeated by Ardashir I. Always passionate about the development of art and architecture, the Sassanids, in their 400 years of rule, built many structures and cities, among them the port of Siraf. The conquest of Iran by Muslim Arabs and the eventual end of the Sassanid rule could not stop the increasing growth of Siraf. It remained one of the most important trade ports in the world for hundreds of years. Siraf had become so crowded that 3- and 4-story buildings were erected and corpses were buried in stone graves in the surrounding mountains. Goods reached the Siraf port by big merchant ships and were distributed in the region through a network of roads, bridges, and caravanserais, and finally exchanged in the marketplace. Some of those markets are still as active as they used to be. Pottery, silk, porcelain, spices, perfumes, and precious stones from India, and wood and ivory from Africa were part of the goods exchanged in those marketplaces. In return, Persian Gulf pearls, rose water, perfumes, garments, textiles, precious carpets, minerals, and even bitumen were exported from the ports of the Persian Gulf by skilled Iranian and non-Iranian satyrs to other parts of the world. In the past, the port of Galhad, in today's Oman, was also one of the other major ports of the Persian Sea. In those days, the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Oman, and a significant part of the Indian Ocean were all called the Persian Sea. Rulers of Persia used to govern Galhad and other ports and islands in the sea. The Galhad port was mentioned in the travelogues of Marco Polo and other visiting travelers. Today, similar historical sites can be seen in some parts of East Africa. The structures and buildings and the coasts were made by immigrants from Iran. In the 10th century AD, a person named Ali bin Hassan, along with his family, moved from the city of Shiraz to Siraf and left the port with 7 ships to the east and northeastern parts of Africa, today known as Kenya and Tanzania, and established a new government there. The Shirazian people were originally Persian. Their distinctive characteristic? Interaction with other people and nations with great respect for their beliefs. The Persian king, Cyrus the Great, founded the Achaemenid Empire in the 6th century BC. He is well recognized for his achievements in human rights, politics, military strategy, as well as influence on both Eastern and Western civilizations. Signs of moral characteristics can be seen in the remains of the Achaemenid relics. The way Achaemenid soldiers treated the representatives of affiliated nations are clearly visible there. The Shirazian people treated native East Africans and other African civilizations with respect and succeeded in changing the areas under their rule into thriving business centers. This went on until certain events changed the situation in the world during that period. Another thriving port of ancient times was Harira, an ancient 8th century city located in what is now called Kish Island in Iran. In 976 AD, the port of Siraf was devastated by a massive earthquake. As the result, the port of Harira gradually became the main trade center in the Persian Sea. During this period, the Portuguese began to occupy islands and shores of the Persian Gulf. The Iranian Safavid government had become embroiled in a long conflict with the Ottoman Empire to prevent them from entering the Persian territory. The Portuguese took advantage of the opportunity and constructed their own fortresses in the region. Albuquerque believed that the island of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf was one of the world's three strategic locations. To him, having control over the island would result in the domination of global maritime trade. Thus, he built a strong fortress there. Since the Hormuz island is geologically a salt dome lacking fresh water, Albuquerque built a supply fort to be able to store this vital liquid. He also stockpiled ammunition and necessary supplies for his troops there. Imam Quli Khan, the ruler of Fars province at the time of Shah Abbas Safavi, took his army to the coasts of the Persian Gulf. With the permission of Iran's government, the Dutch established many business offices in Persian Gulf ports. Later on, they gradually closed their offices and moved to Hark Island, where they started to build castles and deploy heavy weapons. Then Emir of Hark, Mir Mahna, saw the invasion. He began to fight for the liberation of his land. At the age of 18 and during the rule of his father over the region, Mir Mahna also took part in the liberation of Bahrain and defeated the occupying Huala Arabs. But this time he took command of the battle himself. Today, there are some people of the Mir Mahna clan still living in the northern coasts of the Persian Gulf. Even now, they preserve their old traditions, such as the important role of the patriarch in addressing the problems and spiritual needs of family members. People living on the edge of the Persian Gulf were very welcoming toward the Dutch in the beginning. But experiencing their tyrannical behavior, they all joined Mir Mahna to free their lands. After 15 years of struggle, Mir Mahna and his followers succeeded in driving the Dutch out of the Persian Gulf and finally raised their waving tribal flag over the Hark Island.
This is the